Welcome. William Evans here, and you are listening to a Living World Conversation. Our guest today is Cheryl Page, speaking with us from Clifton, Colorado, just upstream from Grand Junction. Welcome, Cheryl.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. It's nice to have these dervishing conversations.
Yes. You grew up in Northern California, and you began to study the martial art of Aikido.
Correct.
Would it be accurate to say in practicing Aikido, you begin to learn to flow with life?
Well, if my sensei did it right, then yes. So I'd say that, you know, it's that wonderful thing that happens, right? Where, you know, in the moment, you and I can be in a class, let's say, and we can learn something. But the learning something is really just the planting of a seed, right? And so that flow that you talk about is really, it matures over time into more than just the Webster's definition of what that means. And so at 62, I understand far more than I did at 22 about what that actually means to flow with life. So I guess my understanding has matured.
And I would say it's been the same for me.
Yeah.
So Aikido originated with a Japanese sensei.
Morie Ueshiba.
And it's built on a way of life. The Chinese and the Japanese philosophers both saw a path of cooperation with the natural world and the benefits of it.
Correct. Well, and essentially, Osensei had a spiritual awakening in a garden in, I don't know if it was the 1940s or the 1950s, but essentially the ontological Aikido message is about transforming conflict into harmony by blending with energy. Sort of then you're achieving self-mastery or victory over yourself, and then creating a non-zero sum, right? A collaborative relationship with, let's call it your attacker, you know, with the opponent. So rather than dominating another, it's essentially taking that energy and transforming it. And the priority of Aikido is love, connection, and universal flow over resistance and force, which we hope would lead to inner peace and shared success. But at least at the very rudimentary level, we're taking energy coming at us, which might be in the form of an attack, and how do we transform that so that that energy can keep flowing, but it doesn't impact us. It just, we allow it to move on its way, and we get out of the way.
And we acknowledge that aggressive energy and don't give up our own identity and our own connection with nature.
Exactly. And so it's essentially non-resistance. So instead of fighting, you yield and redirect. So, what does water do in nature? Water always follows the path of least resistance. So finding the easiest path, which is the highest form of intelligence, right? So instead of fighting, you're yielding and redirecting that energy.
So as a water being, if I really take that in and own it, I'm a fluid being within the flow of life.
Yes. And whether we, you know, there, who was it who said, I think it was Richard Bach's Illusions. There was a quote in there. I read that when I was 15 or something. And it said, not being known doesn't stop the truth from being true. And so whether you know you're a water being, whether you know that these things are inherent within you, it doesn't make it not true. It just means that we may not always be, we meaning, you know, Bob in a diner in Indiana may not be aware that he's a water being in the flow of life, you know, but it still exists as truth, regardless of whether we're aware of it or not.
And if water is able to flow around obstacles in the river, can I flow around obstacles in the world and even at home?
Well, I think that that is certainly an extrapolation. And yet there is a level of awareness and I wouldn't say grace as though I need to have grace, but to have room for grace to step in. I don't think that it's just us alone. I think that there is something, whether we call that the quantum field or all that is, or the infinite universe, but there's a partnership that happens that allows that to manifest around us.
And that partnership changes my worldview in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about how you're flowing through life today?
Well, you know, I think that it would be lovely, and you and I have been traveling down the road long enough that we can say, you know, there's days when it's good and days that it's bad. There's never an arrival, right, on this path. Just like water heading down the river, it doesn't arrive somewhere. It always continues to move. And so there's, you know, within my own life, you know, in 2017, my beloved was hit by a vehicle and killed. And, you know, after almost 25 years in oncology clinical research, that was, you know, what did Rumi say, right? It's the wound where the light enters. And there was a crack in my understanding of who I am and what reality really is about with his passing. And so the flow through my life, I would say over the last 8 years, is completely unrecognizable to the flow of my life prior to July 2017.
Wow. I want to know a little bit more about your flow prior to that tragedy. What motivated your move from Northern California to the Roaring Fork Valley?
John Denver and Tom Crum, who your local listeners will know who they are, had the Windstar Foundation in Old Snowmass, and I had come to do an Aikido week-long retreat with the Windstar Foundation. I don't know, I was 22, 23, something like that, and I also came with a hidden agenda, which is I wanted to come and work for Tom and John. And so I came to do the week-long retreat and to petition them to hire me to work with them. And short of a very long story, my petition was successful. And they said, if you go home to California, you pack things up and you come out here, we'll find a job for you. And so it was the intent of working not just with Tom and John because of whoever Tom and John were, but because I saw something different that was being lived and spoken about that really didn't exist in the world around me in quite the way. I wanted to be a part of whatever that was that I couldn't quite name but knew that was important. And so that's how I ended up living in Aspen when I was 22.
Be more specific about what you can understand about what attracted you to Windstar and John and Tom, in addition to what you've said.
Well, you know, when I was, you know, growing up in California in the 70s, for those of your listeners who would remember EST and all the sort of new age workshops and things that were going on, probably around the country, but certainly in Northern California at that time. And Buckminster Fuller was a friend of my parents, and so it was through work that I had done, volunteer work I had done at the Hunger Project, which I first got connected with John and Buckminster Fuller. And again, I was 16 when I first met Bucky Fuller, so what did I know about anything except he was speaking?
He was what?
He was speaking a language that sounded like a space alien. You know, I mean, he was so other in his phraseology and in his way that he communicated things. So at 16, when I first met Bucky and John in California, it's one of those things where some seeds of possibility or potential were planted, but I didn't understand it. I just knew that I wanted to understand more. And then as I attended, the Windstar Foundation had a retreat that I came out to attend a Windstar Symposium. That's what it was called, the Windstar Symposium in Snowmass. And that was probably when I was 21. And so just looking at the work that was being done and the things that were being proposed, I did the S training when I was 13 years old. I did transcendental meditation with my family when I was 12 years old. So all of these ideas, these seeds were being planted, but I didn't really have the mental construct to understand what it was supposed to mean. It was almost like if you gave me, oh, this is a funny example. You know how people will go to IKEA and they'll buy something, but you don't get to buy something built at IKEA. You have to bring it home and build it, right?
Right.
And so it's like that. I was given all of these pieces, but I still had to construct it myself, and I didn't really know how to construct it. So I suspected that potentially with working with Tommy and John, I might be able to learn how to put together all of these pieces that I had received from the time I was 12 until I moved to Colorado when I was 22.
There's another thread I want to bring into this conversation now, and you may have to tell me when it entered your life, but you began to form an understanding of health as well as disease. And how did that evolve in your consciousness and awareness?
Well, it's a bit of a loaded question because, you know, if we bypass the years that I worked with Tommy and John and we move forward to, you know, my moving east when I left Aspen, moving east and working for Dartmouth College and then for Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, and I sort of pragmatically, you know, at some point you grow up and you have to get a real job. And so I moved east and got a job within academic medicine in clinical research. And so I would say that up to 2017, I was sort of deeply ensconced in sort of the academic left brain construct of medicine and health as you get sick and you go to the doctor.
Right.
And that isn't the model that I understand now, but that was a metamorphosis over time. So I don't know exactly when that change happened, but my conditioning, if you will, was in the academic allopathic model for decades, or for two decades anyway.
And so to come into present time, how do you understand health today?
No pressure here. Let me think about this for a second now, how to put that into words. To me, there is so much more that exists as potential for health and wellness than the allopathic model makes us aware of. So I've done some work with Dr. Joe Dispenza and his research team, and one of the things that Dr. Dispenza says is, if something exists as a potential and you're not aware of it, then it doesn't exist as a potential for you. So there are many things that exist as potentials for healing and for wellness, whether that's what I tell people all the time is that prevention is much less expensive than cure, but we're taught about cures more than we're taught about really meaningful preventative modalities, if you will. And so I think that there is a way to be really uniquely responsible, and I think we need to be uniquely responsible for our wellness choices, but and this is an over-exaggeration to make my point. We are indoctrinated to cure, not prevention, generally, the allopathic model.
Well, and I'm trained as an MD to find pathology.
Yes.
And so how do you understand health now? It's a potential that you are becoming aware of. And how is it manifesting in you?
Well, I'm not exactly sure where you're what you're driving at, so I don't know exactly how to answer the question. It's a personal choice. So tell me more about what it is that you're driving at.
Well, health is a very different objective than treating disease.
Exactly. So prevention versus cure.
And if we know how to evoke and maintain a healthy balance, we can self-correct much of what we perceive to be disease or deal with disease that someone identifies and diagnoses and tells us we have. But that learning to evoke and maintain a healthy balance, for me, is central to understanding the potential of health.
Okay.
So how do you understand health, and how does it manifest in your life today?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, for me now versus, let's say, 2017, for me now, I look at health, if we're talking about my health, I look about it like a wheel. You know, I'm at the hub of that wheel, and you know, there's emotional health, and there's spiritual health, and there's physical health. You know, there's the spokes represent different ways, because I can be incredibly healthy physically, but if my emotions are not intact, then the whole wheel isn't going to operate. All of those spokes have to be stable in order for transport to happen. So I look at it in much more of a holistic sense than I ever did before. It was just, I either feel good or I don't feel good. You know, I was rather pedantic in my view of health, let's say prior to 2017, and certainly prior to COVID. You know, COVID changed the landscape in a lot of ways for a lot of people, as far as understanding about the responsibility for one's own health and the choices that we need to make outside of just what our when I was raised in the 1960s, you just go to your doctor and your doctor tells you, as opposed to having sovereignty and autonomy as far as, you know, making wise choices. But for me, it's a holistic, I guess, in short answer to your question is, I see it as, I'm not healthy if all of those spokes aren't stable. I don't get to just say, I feel good today, so I'm healthy, because you and I both know that that can be an illusion.
Right. And health is alive for me. It's growing and taking on meaning every day, every step.
Yeah.
And it's the amazing thing of growing to be a little bit older. To realize I continue to learn and heal and recover and increasingly acknowledge the inherent potential for healing that is overlooked and underrated and not an active part of our educational system at the level that I would think it would merit.
Well, and you and I both know, if I use clinical research as an example, you know, let's just say pharmaceutical trials in treating disease, you know, phase 1 through phase 4 trials, that it takes a very long time from the time an idea is born and implemented through the phases of those trials before it's actually, if we're lucky, deemed dispensable to the public. It could be a decade, easily, and many multiples of millions of dollars. So even though there is data that exists, what I find is that there needs to be a mechanism through which that data can be disseminated out to the wider world. And I can tell you from my work with Dr. Joe Dispenza that I have witnessed, and it's not miracle, I don't use it in that term, but I have seen what some people would call miraculous, quote-unquote, healings, where someone attends a week-long retreat, and they came in a wheelchair, and they walked out without it. Someone who couldn't speak left being able to speak. That, what's the A plus B equals C? What's the mechanism of action that caused that transformation, more than just sitting in a chair for 36 hours and meditating? There is something that transpired and something that is possible within, not just, I would say, within the human body, but between the interaction of the relationship between the human body and the quantum field. There is so much more healing that is possible, and yet we are, it's almost like we say, okay, the only store in our town is a hardware store, and you can only buy anything you need from the hardware store. That's the way that I was raised with allopathic medicine. When you're sick, you go to the doctor. But there are other options, and there are certainly many people more eloquent and educated than I as far as homeopathy and complementary and alternative modalities. And, you know, it was a paradigm shift for me to sit there beside a man in a wheelchair who hadn't walked in 10 years and that he left that event on his own two feet. What's that? That tells me that there's more information that if something exists as a potential and I'm not aware of it, then it doesn't exist as a potential for me. What is that that happened that man sat in a chair and, quote unquote, meditated for 36 hours and he was able to get out of the wheelchair for the first time in 10 years? Then that tells me there's a whole lot more potential than we're tapping into.
The way I would say what I hear you saying is that healing can be like waking up.
Yes, but I don't think it's as simple as that to the degree that there is a mechanism of action. There is an A plus B equals C to it. It's not just I was asleep and I awoke. You can awake to a potential, but you still have to take the action. And those people, you know, like if I just use that example with the retreat with Dr. Dispenza, those people didn't just wake up. They were introduced to a field of potential that they actually were taught how to tap into that. And within that relationship between us and the quantum field, let's say, there are potentials. I don't think it's somebody from heaven reached up and healed that person. I think it's heaven, you know, those capacities are within us, but we need to not just awaken them, but understand what the mechanism of action is to activate them. It's kind of like the car, right? My car has the potential, but if I don't put the keys in and turn the engine and put it in drive, then all it is potential. So I think we all have the potential, but what's the mechanism of action where we can actually drive the vehicle?
For me, part of waking up is getting up and getting into action.
Yeah.
Beginning to live my life with a new awareness.
Yeah.
So are you still involved in research?
No, I retired from my job at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in April of this year. So that was the end of a 24-year career and sort of moving on to other pursuits.
So that's a huge transition.
Yes, it is. And a little bit of courage required because I've always had someone writing me a paycheck. I've never been self-generative in the way of, you know, making a living, but it became the journey from July of 2017 to now has awakened in me so many more potentials that I didn't know existed before then. And so it was enough to have me head down on some other paths and see where that leads. But, you know, one other thing I wanted to interject, because, you know, if you think about the Western education system, and this will sound like I'm diverging off into the weeds, but I think that this will be useful in our conversation. So prior to World War One, and this is a generalization, but to make the point, prior to World War One, the education system was more based on the antiquity, the seven liberal arts of the trivium and the quadrivium. That was more, so what that construct of that education system was, we're going to teach you how to think. But then World War One comes around and we need some factory workers, and the education structure changed to, we're going to teach you what to think. Here's the book. The answers we want you to have are in the book. Memorize the answers, take the test, get an A on the test, and now you have the truth, air quotes. But we lose something important in that model, because there's an illusion of certainty that there is only a binary. There's only true and false. But in quantum physics, there's four values of logic, not just two values of logic. But we have been trained to be Newtonian creatures. So if I think there's only true and false, then what is lost? You know, if certainty is the main goal, then if we're only looking for true or false, then we don't have room for more information. So, like, if you think of Schrodinger's cat, right, that great thought experiment, the cat is in the box with the Geiger counter and the radioactive isotope, and we don't know if the cat is dead or alive until we open the box. So in that moment, the cat is suspended in two truths, which is that it's both dead and alive. And that's important to this conversation to the degree that I always say in any interview that, you know, what I share is my understanding from my present level of ignorance, and that I understand if I look at all of human history as a linear line, we've always known some things until we got a little bit more information. Hello, Galileo. You know, oh, I think we got a problem here. I think maybe the Earth is rotating around the sun.
Thank you, Cheryl. Would you be willing to continue this conversation?
Yes, of course I would.
Okay. This is Katie and Kay, and you've been listening to A Living World Conversation with Cheryl Page. Thank you for listening.